Morning.
Good morning. Who's that? Naomi?
Yeah. How's it going?
Good. Brooke Shannon, how are you?
Good. Everyone's in Chicago now. Yeah, that's like me, so.
Oh, you guys there too, or no?
No, we're home.
You're shy, I went.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to tell you something interesting. I know we got a bulldog.
Right.
And I was listening to you talking about like all the you know, the animals and but they can't, you know, you can't produce anything when you interbreed them. So, but I was thinking it's very interesting with the bulldogs. They can't be born without C-section. So they are like the only animal that I've heard of. I don't know if there's any others that they need like human intervention to breed.
Really?
Yeah, because
they're
either too big or something.
Interesting. So, that's kind of hard to explain how they ever got to this point in existence then. I mean, there weren't always people around to do C-sections on them if they first started out at the beginning of creation.
No, they didn't because they're crossbreeds. They're crossbreeds between pugs and some other original bulldog or something.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, the Ramban and the Swarnable say the same thing, that when you crossbreed, the product can't reproduce.
It's funny, I don't mean you have this problem with any other dog crossbreeds. They're like crossbred between two dogs, two different dogs.
Interesting. So you're saying that could be the means by which the species would stop. But now it's an artificial.
Sounds like it, yeah.
I think the example they give, the famous example, is the mule. Doesn't even reproduce, doesn't even get to that point. All right, so what time do you have? Is it, we have 11:15 yet?
Yeah, bye. Yeah.
Should we wait a few more? Doug, Cal, Francesca, Josh? Any of you there?
Good morning, Rabbi. Doug and Gallagher.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Yeah.
Hi, Rivka. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
So I thought, this would be the question from Naomi. She sent the question about, not you, Naomi, from Naomi in India. She had a question that, actually, if you take a look at the Jewish Times, so I took it up. On metaphors, on the book of Proverbs. So I thought maybe we'd go into that a little bit more. Okay, Naomi, good. I'm glad you got to see the reply. She just wrote back. She's joining us right now on the internet. So she's not on the phone, but she can hear us. Or she can write in. And Tina just joined us also. How you doing, Tina? Hope you're doing good. So, John, and also, I sent you, Doug, the link. Did you see it?
I did.
All right, so why don't you...
Question about the article.
Yeah, so why don't you recap the question, my response, and then whatever other follow-up questions there are. So you'll recap it for everybody who's listening now.
Okay, so let me go back to... Let me grab Naomi's email here. So, on behalf of someone in her community, Naomi wrote a number of questions. Number one, why did King Solomon write everything visualized in Proverbs form? Second, was it not true during that time that the temple was there and there were many great rabbis and thinkers who could have better put his thoughts into a holy book in another way? circumstances have an effect to make them write these proverbs? And what made King Solomon do this? And for whom did he speak? Was he writing this down for his subjects at the time or for mankind as a whole? She also asked, why is it so generalized in always in this sort of good versus bad form, or weak versus strong, these contrasts? And why has it been put in a holy book? It can be applied to any religion on the earth today, and many have borrowed borrowed it as well, like the Bhagavad Gita in Hinduism has almost a chunk that was taken from Proverbs. So, thus, that's the whole plethora of questions.
Wow, I didn't see all those questions. I only saw the first two. Those are the, but they're very good questions.
Okay, yeah, we have a few left that that were unanswered. I had just gotten to writing her back on the first couple and was going to follow up on the rest.
Okay.
Which, you know, perhaps we could tackle in this class.
Yeah, I mean, they're very good questions because whoever, I mean, they're not Naomi's questions. They're somebody in Naomi's community.
That's correct. They're a new person in Naomi's community, and she passed them along to me, and so I started to create a response, and then you elaborated considerably in your article in the Jewish Times.
Right, so you'll have to remind me if I address all of them, but I don't think we have any support that says that people spoke in Proverbs during that era. This was something which King Solomon decided to do, apparently, as he says in the outset of his book, to give acumen to the simple people, to sharpen their minds, to make them understand poetic expression and riddles. And this would give wisdom, additional wisdom. So that was the reason why he did it. And he did it for everybody. So I'm answering a lot of questions with a few statements, but this should answer most of the questions you had, Doug. So in terms of who's it for, he did it for everybody. That's why you put a book down, because you want this to be available to everybody. And you see in the beginning where he talks about who is it for the young, for the wise. So that means the entire population. In terms of, let's see, the questions you had was, that was a target audience. Why is it a holy book as opposed to just a regular book? Well, a holy book means that what he wrote was with a divine inspiration. So that's why it naturally became a part of the writings, part of the corpus of the Torah.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Do we hold that it was divinely inspired, or that King Solomon was just a very wise man and worked it all out?
No, in order for it to be part of the Torah, it has to be divinely inspired. But you even see an additional thing, that King Solomon was given knowledge miraculously when he was 12 years old. So that means the knowledge that he expressed subsequent, there you see more proof that it was divinely inspired, as opposed to somebody like King David, where it doesn't say that God gave King David or anybody else miraculous knowledge. It's only seen in connection with King Solomon. So anything which is of divine inspiration, that's why it becomes part of the Torah. I mean, it's something which is 100% accurate ideas. And, you know, coming from God's inspiration. So, as Rabbi Chay explained, the Torah itself, the five books of Moses, really contains everything. Everything subsequent to that, which means the additional two books of prophets and writings, are elaborations of the five books of Moses. So you won't find anything new in prophets and writings. But you'll find maybe more extensive expression of certain ideas. But that's what we say, everything is in the five books. But nonetheless, all three are divinely inspired.
considered prophecy what he wrote, or just that he had inspiration as he did it, and I'm not sure how I would define the difference.
Yeah, there's different levels of prophecy, from what I understand. And we talk about the spiritual inspiration, like what they say, Ruach HaKodesh, like a divine inspiration. So that's not really a state where the person is unconscious. A real state of prophecy, except for Moses, the person has to be unconscious. He's not experiencing something in a waking state. So whatever was written here, however, was inspired somehow, you know, from God. And that's why it's absolutely true. And that's what gives the credibility to the Torah, to those three books. And so that answers a couple of questions. Now, what other questions do we have on there?
Let's see. What context or what were the prevailing circumstances then, and did those circumstances make them write these proverbs? And what made King Solomon speak them? And for whom did he speak them, his subjects or for mankind?
Well, he wrote it for all mankind, we already said. Now, he says openly in the beginning, for the young, for the old, for the wise. The reason he wrote it, he says as well, to give wisdom. Now, the question, of course, is again how it works. And I think that's what we really went into, is, you know, how does this specific work offer greater wisdom than the work that's not written in this format? And he uses a number of different methods. He uses metaphor. He uses there were the Maimonides, Rambam, he calls simile. He uses poetic expression, or melitza, what they call it, expressive talk. He personifies. He makes, like, he talks about wisdom. That was one of the examples I gave, where he personifies wisdom as if wisdom is talking to a person. Wisdom can't talk. Wisdom is just the abstract knowledge. But what he uses that in order to get an idea across. He also does something throughout the book, which is where he parallels two slightly different ideas in one verse. And we talked a bit about that too. That was in order to see a person by definition. There's certain things that are not learnt in life. Certain things that are learnt. Now there's one thing which is not learnt, and that's at the root of all knowledge. And the thing which is not learnt is the mind's comparing, the act of comparing. What do I mean comparing? When an infant sees a strange face, it cries. Because the mind is instantly comparing it. Is this a face that's familiar to it from youth? So you see that there is this emotion of familiarity which helps to create a sense of equilibrium in a human being. And that starts right from youth. So the child sees a face repeatedly, the mother, the father. So then it becomes sedate. It becomes satisfied. This is comforting. It's something which is he's familiar with. When something strange, a new face they never saw, so it's different. And this is something which is scary to the child. It's uncomfortable. But the reason why it can recognize this, and it's still an infant that's just a few weeks old, is because the person constantly compares. And you see, this face doesn't look like the one I know already. And that's how a person also knows where he is on the street. He can recognize where he is right now compared to where he was 5 minutes ago. So he knows he has to make a turn, but not at this moment. Maybe at the next corner. Or in terms of a person's writing. So he writes a couple of letters, the formal word, and he realizes the next letter that he has to write because of what's already there. So comparison is something which is allows a person to distinguish and to know what time of day it is, where he's at, is this person my friend or somebody I never met before, and so on and so forth. Now, is that clear? Before I go further.
Yep.
Okay. So now that we see the comparison is something which is an automatic, it's reflexive. It's something which is programmed into us. another thing which is programmed into us is to know whether something is similar or not. And that's part of the comparison. Meaning when the infant sees a new face, so this registers as not being similar, but it's only comes up with that result because it first had the process of comparison that went on instantaneously in the mind. Now, it's interesting, though, the child never saw anything, that, you know, two things that are identical. Like for example, to give an example where you have two cubes or two balls on the table. So they're not perfectly identical because one's on the right, one's on the left. So in terms of identical, that's an impossibility. You can only have, there's only one thing which is identical, and that's itself. Something can only be identical with itself. It could look similar, but you see that concept, that the person knows that there are things that are similar, is something also which is programmed. Even though there was never a training point, the child is just born with that. Okay. But now once we have this, we have this understanding that the mind is always comparing. So it's through comparison that a person can see greater truths. So if I tell you, like, you know, quoting King Solomon, that a person who's foolish and lives a corrupt life and he ends up, he's devastated, so he's going to try to escape from his tragic circumstances. Once he makes wrong decisions and ends up, you know, let's say he's impoverished, whatever it is, because he wasn't using intelligence during his life, so he'll try to escape, he'll try to get out of it. And King Solomon says that wisdom speaks to a person like this, and wisdom says that you'll call me, but I won't answer. You'll seek me out, but you won't find me. So that's something that may sound similar. You know, you're going to try to get out of your problem by engaging wisdom somehow. So, you know, if you just look at the verse simply, so you'll say that King Solomon is just saying that the person's going to, you know, try to escape his tragic circumstances. But what he does is that he puts two slightly different statements together. And that is so that can pronounce the nuances of distinction between the two. Because if you just say one, like this week, hey, you know, you're going to try to find me, but you won't, you're going to call me, but I won't answer. All right, next week you tell the person you're going to seek out wisdom, but you won't find it. The person's going to think, you said the same thing to me last week. But if you align both of them together in close proximity, in time or in one verse, so now he's faced with both of the verses. Now you can compare the two halves and see that there's slight differences. In the first case, he says, you're going to call me, but I won't answer. The second case, King Solomon's rebuke of the fool is that you're going to seek me out, but you won't find me. So you could say that calling and not answering means to say in terms of the intellectual sphere. The person's in tragic circumstances, so he'll try to figure a way out. But since he's not an intelligent person, he never engaged wisdom his whole life, so then he has no tools at his disposal that are intelligent tools. He has never refined his mind. He has never become somebody that knows how to think and to think strategically, which is one of the statements that King Solomon makes at the beginning of the book in terms of what the purpose is. So that's one thing that's going to fail in terms of the fool trying to escape his circumstances. Another thing, meaning to say, in terms of a plan or thinking out, he won't be able to come up with any type of strategy. So that's what calling out means. Meaning it's just using intelligence, but there won't be an answer. Meaning he won't find any solution. That's what it means, he won't get an answer. Wisdom won't answer him. His mind cannot answer him. Another thing he may try to do is just practically, you know, go this way, go this way, try different things physically in action. So there King Solomon says also that you'll seek me out, meaning practically. Seeking means like, you know, you're looking around, you're moving around, you know, geographically. But you're not going to find me, meaning to say that even if you try to have practical solutions, that also will fail. And it's also due to the fact that the person has no intelligence. So you see that initially you may look at something as being very similar, a statement, two statements can be very similar. But by putting them together and overlapping them, so to speak, you can see where there are differences. And then you could pick up on what those differences are. And once you see the differences, that allows you to make new inroads into wisdom. And that's one of the methods that King Solomon used. And I also mentioned in the article that it's not really different from reality, because when a person looks at one tree, he can appreciate it and so on. If he looks at another tree, he can also have a certain appreciation, but if he contrasts the different type of structure and the leaves and so on and where they grow, then he can start making deductions. So the ability to make that comparison and to derive new things by comparing two things that are similar or two things that are distinct, that always exists. But what King Solomon did with his book is he understood how the mind works. That comparison is it's a most fundamental tool in terms of knowledge. That's really where you derive, where you see new insights when something's pronounced. So you see something new, you see a new type of an animal. That's because you already have a certain concept about animals. But if a person saw an animal for the first time, he wouldn't really focus in on the color of the hair or the length of the ears, because he just, that's new to him just right off the bat, just the whole creature. But then when he has enough animals in front of him, he can start seeing varying designs, and he can start asking questions. Why is the fin of the shark vertical? And why is the fin of the dolphin and mammals, why are they horizontal? And they ask, that's a big question. What's the difference between the two? And he realizes. He says, oh, the mammals, they need to breathe, and they have a spout on their top. So in order to force them upwards out of the water, which is what you see a lot of porpoises and dolphins, they swim that way. So the pushing down of a heart, and that can only happen if you have a horizontal fin. So when you push down, so that forces the opposite motion of the dolphin going upwards. But that can only work if your fin is horizontal, so it could push down the back of the dolphin and propel it. At the same time, it could move vertically, and it can exit the water, get air, and go back in. But fish don't need that, like sharks and all the other fish. So that's why the fin is just used for propelling. It's not used for elevation. So you can have that with a vertical fin. But you wouldn't know that if you just looked at the first fish. So it's through comparison that you see distinctions, and then you derive why there's a distinction. So that exists in nature. But what King Solomon did is that he took a whole slew of these and put them he juxtaposed them together in verses in order to force the distinctions to be brought out more and to train the person. And now once the person sees that this is how the world works, now when he goes back to his day, he now can use this in all areas. So it's very interesting when you see what exactly he did in terms of the book. All right, let me stop here and see if there's any questions or comments.
I hear.
Good here.
Okay. So now let's talk about metaphor, because metaphor is really what the name of the book is, Mishle. Mishle means the plural of mushle. So mushle is a metaphor. And Mishle is the plural. So Proverbs really is not the accurate translation. Now what is a metaphor? What is the use of metaphor? So what I had suggested is that when do you use a metaphor? let's say you have a child, and this is the example I used in the article. And your child's getting older, he's 8 years old, 9 years old, 10. So now you want to try to keep on educating them. So now let's say you want to start teaching them a little bit about psychology. At 5 or 6, the kid's not ready yet. But 9, 7, 8, 9 are ready. The kid is ready for this. You can tell him something. So you want to express to him the idea of guilt. It's an emotion. So how do you explain this to him? So you tell him that, because we know what guilt is. Guilt is something which holds us back from acting. You feel guilty about something, that's really the purpose of it. That's why God gave it to Adam and Eve. Because since they sinned pretty quickly, it was the same day they got the command that they sinned. Actually, and I think the Ron, one of the Rishonim, he says it was the same hour. The same hour that they got the command they sent. That means that there was no break system. Once they had this desire, that's it. There was nothing holding them back. So God gave them the conscience, the guilt, in order that the next time a person would sin, he may feel, you know, reticent. He may feel a little bit uneasy about going through with something because now he feels bad. So that helps the person to stop, to think, and to express this to a child who's nine, to say, what is guilt? You can tell them, well, it's sort of like a wall that's inside of you, and it can stop you from going further. So he knows what a wall is. So you're using wall as a metaphor, and that can now awaken in his mind, he grasps something which is an obstacle. And if he doesn't know what the word obstacle is, so you give him some examples of that, and you use a metaphor, or you use examples. So once he sees enough examples, so that builds up a certain sense of what the idea is. But if you want to, you know, bring the child further into new areas of knowledge, so you use that which he's familiar with. That's the idea of a metaphor. You call on the reservoir of knowledge that the person already has, and you talk about things in his own language, what he's familiar with. And this way he can understand the words that you're using, and now it can transpose this concept of a wall, of an obstacle, onto the world of psychology. Oh, there's something inside of me called guilt that it's like a wall. It stops you from doing things. And then he can start perceiving this happening in his waking state. You know, while he's fully, waking state, in his day-to-day actions, he can see where maybe a friend took something, was a hit, he was going to raise his hand to hit his friend, but he held back, and then he could talk to you about it, and you say, oh, that was your guilt at work. It held you back, so you can see how it works. So this is, I believe, is one of the benefits of metaphor, that it allows you to bring a person into a new area of knowledge that he has not experienced yet by using the tools of the vocabulary or his experience. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
It seems, interestingly, as a parallel, that that's also how teachers teach math. Because they'll take a certain, say, story problem that introduces an idea and put it in front of the students. You know, talk about how it's solved and talk about the generalized idea behind it, and then turn around and have the students go work many, many problems centered around that idea, but they're all different, so that they get practical application in the concept.
I say it's good. So there they're trying to have the student apply to make sure that the rule is extracted. Because sometimes what happens is you tell a person something and you say, don't eat cashews because, you know, you're going to gain weight. So they'll stop eating cashews and they'll eat all the other types of nuts. So they really haven't gotten the rule. Really what you wanted to tell them is that this type of a food, nuts in general, if it's very fatty, so then you shouldn't be involved. Same thing with steak. You tell them this is too much cholesterol. So he stops eating steak and he starts eating salami, made from the same thing, even worse, it's processed and so on and so forth. So what you want to do, the best thing is really to teach a rule, but to teach a rule, you have to start with examples. So sometimes the examples itself, when you have a number of them, then the student can extract the rule. He sees a rule. So you tell him, don't have franks, don't have salami, don't have steak, all these different things, and just like have maybe, you know, twice a month, three times a month, the most, whatever. Now he understands. So he'll move on to vegetables or something else, but he won't make the mistake anymore because enough of the examples allow the person to draw parallels. Because again, the mind is working in terms of comparison, and now the mind can make a deduction. Oh, all these things have something in common. So the same way the comparison can show you distinctions, and open up doors to insight. It can also show you, common denominators, and that too gives you that ability to derive new insight. And there's also progression where you speak about one idea and then another idea follows. So you wonder why. What's the follow? What's the follow through? What's the sequence? Sequence or order? This is also a method by which you see that the Torah works. And then you've seen, many times as we're going through, Koheles. We always ask, well, what's the reason that King Solomon said this verse on the heels of the previous verse? Is there a context that he's creating? Is it a further expression of the previous idea? Was the previous idea just theory? And now the following verse is talking about the practical. So by having these tools, it helps us in terms of the approach. So in general, the purpose is for the sake of sharpening the person. But what he's doing is he's bringing into focus and the very methods that the mind can use, without Mishlei. But he brings them into stark contrast here. But it's really a sampling. It's like a very acute sampling of how the world works in general, how the Torah works, how the natural world is. I mean, everything was designed in order to offer insight. But it's only through the person who can see the subtle differences and nuances that he sees greater knowledge. If a person just thinks both halves of the verse are saying the same thing, he's going to miss out on the whole purpose of that verse that King Solomon wrote. But if he studies enough and he sharpens his mind using Proverbs, so then he'll see another verse and he'll start seeing subtle differences between the first half and the second half. Like he says in the beginning, that if he takes the knowledge will end up being like he says in 1:9, there'll be like a crown to your head and like necklaces around your neck. So what does that mean? So he's using a metaphor, the head and the neck. The head and the neck. This is chapter 1, verse 9 in Proverbs. That means to say the head is the seat of thought and the neck is speech, the throat. So if a person becomes wise, so then it will be a benefit to his thinking and to his discussions. There's another example. Let me just go back to Doug. There are other questions, Doug, on that list? In the email?
Let's see. Why is it generalized in good versus bad always, or weak versus strong?
Okay, so let's take that. Well, the book is about benefiting a person. So he's showing what the right and wrong with the the truth and not truth is. So that's really what the benefits is for. That he gives advice at the same time that he's training the mind of the reader with this structure. The content is giving us great insight. Like for example, the one we just read, which was 1:28, that the fool who ignores wisdom his whole life, so then he's going to have the tragic circumstances will befall him, and he'll try to escape, but he won't be able to. So there, we saw the two halves of the verse in terms of the methods of escape he's going to try to apply. But just factually, he's teaching us a factual point that if a person leads a life which is foolish, So then when he gets into circumstances that are negative, so then he won't have the ability to escape. It's like he fell into a deep pit with no rope to climb out. So he's telling you this just in terms of factual. He's trying to teach you, don't lead this life, because if you lead this life where you're not using wisdom, so you're going to end up maybe at a point of no return. So that's you see, the book is talking about that. It's giving, you know, clear counsel in terms of how King Solomon wants to benefit people. So that's what I'd say in terms of why it's talking about these contrasts between, you know, right and wrong, good and bad, truth and non-truths. All right. Was that the last question, Doug?
Last one was, which you, I think, partly answered, was why it has been put in a holy book. It can be applied to any religion on the earth today, and many have borrowed it too, like the Bhagavad Gita in Hinduism has almost a chunk taken from Proverbs.
That's interesting. Which book cannibalized Proverbs?
The Bhagavad Gita in Hinduism.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. The Quran did the same thing. Quran took response, like there's two approaches you can go to when you meet with the, you know, you're trying to lie about something, or you're trying to take, you're trying to compete like the other religions. It's like, what did Christianity do? It copies so much of the Torah. Like Joseph was sold for 20 pieces of silver, and Jesus was sold for 30, or whatever. And the names are very similar, Jesus and Joseph, and there's a verse where God tells Moses in the Torah that he'd go back down to Egypt now to save the Jews, because all the people that sought his life are dead. And it's the exact same thing in connection with Jesus. So what they tried to do is to borrow biblical-sounding statements and to fabricate a story around Jesus in order to lend credibility. What the Quran does, it says, and, you know, it now came after Judaism and Christianity, and what it says is that we gave you Jesus, and we gave you Moses, and we did this, and we did that. Meaning, it realizes that these things are accepted, these books were accepted, so the strategy of the writers of the Quran was to take credit for the major religions, as if it's now a super religion that's responsible for Christianity and Judaism. You see the transparency of what they're doing. You see the same thing with this book, but maybe this book, the Hindu book, they like the ideas. But I'm sure it doesn't say, you know, footnote, you know, taken from King Solomon's Proverbs. I'm sure that's not there. So, you know, when new religions come out, so they try to gain footing by paralleling the accepted ones. Okay. Here's another verse, which we may have mentioned a few times in the class. This is Proverbs 2, verse 4. And it says, if a person's trying to find wisdom, so he says, if you seek it out like silver and like a buried treasure, you chase after it. And 5, he says, then you'll understand the wisdom of God, and the knowledge of God will you find. So 2:4 sounds like, you know, the same thing. Seek it out like silver, like a buried treasure, you chase after it. So now think about the two. What's the difference, though? You put two statements together to contrast one against the other, and that contrast should bring out distinctions, and those distinctions should not give you a new idea. So let's just do this as an exercise. So he's talking about wisdom, and he says, what's your approach to wisdom? What must it be? if you seek it out like silver, and you chase after it like a buried treasure. Right, that's the first step you have to make. Silver is it has an identity. The buried treasure doesn't.
I suppose now I have to relate those two.
You there, Doug? Okay, since we got cut off, let's call back in.
If you are there are currently 5 other participants in the conference.
Okay, I've got cut off the line, Doug.
Oh.
I'm sorry, but the last 30 seconds or so.
Okay, so what I was saying, I was assuming that the next step would be to relate the silver and the treasure to the world of learning and ideas.
Right.
Okay, and that what I would do is say, well, silver means something I know that I'm going after. So I have a particular problem, particular situation in life, and I want to know what's the answer. So I'm digging around through Michelet, trying to find out the answer to a specific known question or known problem. That says you're going after silver. In other words, you know what the thing is you're going after, but you still have to dig it out and find it. Whereas the buried treasure, I'm not so much facing a particular problem or issue. It's just that I want to be involved in learning, and so I'm digging around because I know there's treasure here, and I'm going to dig around and see what I find.
Okay, so you're not looking for a specific solution, is what you're saying. So there's two ways two ways of study. One is when you have a specific question, and one is where you don't.
Right.
Okay, that's good. I like that. And in both cases, you know it's of value, though. That's something which we have to say. Meaning that I would just add that when you're looking for silver, so or buried treasure, in both cases, your attitude towards learning is that you know that there's something here that is, again, and the second thing, it's not only of a value, but it's below the surface. So if it's something which you still have to locate. So it's there is a process of digging. There is a process of seeking it out. So, and we know that silver is in the ground as well as a buried treasure. So, but there's the buried quality, you see, also. But the second one, it's something which is, you don't know what it is. It's also below the surface. You know that you have to seek it. But you also have the attitude that there's a value. So if that's your attitude when you learn, if you're seeking it out as something which is like a precious commodity, so then that's something that King Solomon says is necessary if you really want to get the wisdom of God, because wisdom of God is a deep thing. And the only way that you can get it is if you have this, you're seeking it like a valuable thing. What also helps, because again, it is something you have to unravel. It is a process of deduction and reasoning and induction. So it's not something which is laying on the surface. Also, it's something which has a value. So this means that when you find something, if it doesn't measure up to the value of silver, you know you dismiss it. That's another aspect of this, is that when you're looking for knowledge and truth, there's a certain taste that it has. It has a certain value. And if it, there's a certain clarity and truth to the truth when you find an answer to something. And if it's not something which you, is like, you know, shining like silver, then you know you really haven't hit the mark yet in terms of getting the answer. So there's a number of facets to what's going on over here that is below the surface, that sometimes you, like you were saying, Doug, sometimes you know what you're looking for, so it's silver. Sometimes you don't know, you're just studying, so it's, but it just is like a buried treasure. You don't have, it doesn't have an identity yet. But you know it's below the surface. You know that you have to uncover. You know you have to have an attitude, meaning the attitude is that there's something very precious here, something of great value. And the last thing we said is that the fact that it has that value allows you to look at what you arrived at and say, is this really what the meaning is? Or is this not really a worthwhile statement? Meaning, does it carry the same weight as silver? Is it really the same weight in my eyes like a buried treasure? If not, then dismiss it. So it also is giving you a barometer for whether or not you found something of value.
Rabbi, could the silver correspond to verses 5, the fear of the Lord, and the treasures correspond to the knowledge of God from verse 5?
Let's see. He says, if you do this, the next verse says, I mean, if you look for knowledge like silver, like a buried treasure, then you will understand the fear of God, and the knowledge of God will you find. I don't know. I'd say what he's saying over there is that there is two things in terms of a person's attitude. That's why you have there's two commands in the Torah. One is to fear God, and one is to love God. So fear really means that you have the attitude of that God is, you're just awestruck. You have a certain estimation that God holds a place that nothing else does. So that's fear of God. And knowledge is the positive. That's what you can have a love for when you see new ideas. Meaning you'll cover both. You'll address both primary laws in the Torah. If you search out for wisdom with this type of an attitude, with this elevated value, then, because if you're not looking for something of great value, you'll be satisfied with very little. And then you won't really see the beauty that really awaits you. But there's two areas. There's two responses that are necessary. One is that the person has continued growing awe of God, and the other one is that there's continued appreciation for the positive wisdom that he gets. All right, you want to take one more verse? We have time. Unless there's any questions.
Sure.
Okay, so the next verse says that, and this is 2:6, another beautiful verse. And now it's just key, because, meaning he's explaining now why, if you follow his instructions of seeking out wisdom like silver, like a buried treasure, and then you'll find the fear and knowledge of God, but the reasoning is, he says, because God gives forth wisdom from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. The first half of the verse says, it is because God is the one who gives wisdom, and from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. He's explaining now why this is so. That the search has to be one where it's you're chasing after like a valuable treasure, silver. And then you'll get the fear and knowledge of God. But the reason why you have to do this is because of this verse now. Because God gives forth wisdom, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding.
Rabbi, you said that was 236?
No, 2:6. The next verse. Proverbs 2, chapter 2, verse 6.
Well, it would seem like the second part, when it says from his mouth are knowledge and discernment, it would seem like that means the combination of the knowledge, the information of what's happening in a particular situation, and a discernment would be how to understand and apply that. If you just have facts, that doesn't help you, but you need to know how the facts are to be applied in various contexts.
Well, the verse says, because God gives forth knowledge, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. God gives forth wisdom, and then he says, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. So let's just understand that factually, what are the nuances between the two halves of the verse? I'm not denying what you're saying, but I'm not sure that's what the verse is telling us. First half of the verse is saying that it's because God gives forth wisdom. Who is the source of the wisdom? I believe is what he's focusing in on. Meaning the reason why you have to seek after wisdom like silver and buried treasure is because you have to have the cognizance, the recognition of the source of the wisdom. It's God who's giving it forth. Oh, I know this is something which God wrote. Now I have to be extremely careful and completely unsatisfied with simplistic answers. But not only that, there's another part to the verse that says, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. What do you mean his mouth? What do we mean by God's mouth? He doesn't have a mouth. But what does a mouth do? A mouth is something which articulates. So what he's telling us here is that there's two things. First, you must know that it's God is the source of where the wisdom is coming from. But he says from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding, is that a person appreciates the articulated word in the Torah, in the five books, in the prophets, in the writings. Meaning the very structure has such a high-level design, from that you can derive tremendous amounts. So King Solomon is telling you the reason why you've got to seek it out like silver, like a buried treasure, is because two things. It's coming from God, so that itself has to make you realize that there's an infinite amount of wisdom here. This God created the universe. The scientists are still just scratching the surface about how it works. But not only that, since we're talking about a study of Torah, so then we must appreciate that the articulated word has such a unique design. And that should be what we're going after in terms of understanding. You see it? not clear? So I'm trying to say that the verse, if we were very careful about reading the verse, for God gives forth wisdom. Well, that's not nothing new. Why? That's a new thing? No, he's trying to say that God, let's underline the right word here. God is the one that's giving forth the wisdom, because the source, that's who's highlighting. But not only is God the source of the wisdom that you're trying to study, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding, meaning from appreciating what he articulated. The divinely inspired words. So by studying them and asking the questions, this verse is a very good example, because this is divinely inspired, and we're asking on, what does this mean? That God gives forth wisdom from his mouth. We're taking the very words of this verse, and we're deriving new ideas because of the whole way this verse was articulated. All right?
Yep.
All right, any other questions? Was that somebody wanted
Rabbi?
To... Yes?
Rabbi? Yeah, I'm just wondering if God, Hashem, is giving us, the wisdom. He's making it available to us in so many words. It's up to us to grasp it, to get it, to take it. Is that what you're trying to say?
No. I'm saying that the... The reason why a person has to have the attitude of seeking wisdom like a very precious commodity is because he should know what the wisdom is. The nature of this wisdom has two properties. One is that its source is God. And number two is that the design of the articulated words in the Torah contain tremendous ideas, just the design itself, the structure. The articulations. He's explaining how, what should be our attitude of seeking it out like silver, like the buried treasure, has to come from the fact that the one telling us this is God, and that he took care also in terms of how he wrote it down through his prophets.
Okay. Yes. But we can seek it from so many different sources. The prophets are offering also the wisdom. It's all coming from Hashem. But we have to seek it out. And there are different sources to seek it from.
Well, the design of the verses. That's true, but that's not what the verse is saying. The verse is saying that we know it's coming from God. That's one thing we have to be cognizant of. Like if a child tells you something, you don't pay the same attention as if Einstein tells you something. So that's one reason why you'll pay attention. But also, if Einstein writes something down, you're going to be very careful about how to read it. You don't think it's just a very quickly careless type of a statement. So there's two reasons why you'll listen, okay? That's what he's saying here.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Rabbi?
Yes.
So I'm curious, in your article, you refer to Solomon as the world's second wisest man.
Yep.
And I thought that King Solomon was the world's wisest man.
No, they say he's wisest second to Moses. That's what the rabbis say.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought Moses was considered the humblest, but that Solomon was considered the wisest.
No, I'll have to find where it was. I actually just saw it, I think, last week. I'll see if I can locate the source for you, but that's something we should round by say.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you even have the Torah. The Torah says that Moses asked God to show him his true nature. And God says, you can't understand me while I'm alive, but my face you won't see, but my back you will see. That means that Moses was given a certain level of wisdom that nobody else received. He surpassed, he didn't surpass Solomon because he came before Solomon. that Solomon was only second to Moses. And again, this conforms to what we said at the outset today, that all the knowledge is in the five books of Moses. Prophets and writings are reiterations of those primary concepts. That means everything we got from Moses is not, it's complete. And there's nothing new that King Solomon added onto it. So that actually backs up what we said. All right, so maybe we'll wrap it up here. I know you got another class. It's about 12:15 now. So we'll pick up, go back into Kahelis a week from today. All right?
All right. Thanks, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Thank you
very much.
Okay, my pleasure. Have a good week, everybody.
You too.
You too.
Everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.